Thanks for tuning in for the May 19th podcast. I'm Jeff Ratliff, Deputy Section Editor of the Neurology Podcast. This week's featured interview highlights the first part of a discussion Jason Crowell had with Nancy Wexler on her life's work devoted to Huntington's disease. For our other segment, you'll hear the latest on PFO and stroke.
Hey, this is Jason Crowell with the Neurology Podcast, and we have a special guest today for the podcast. A few weeks ago, I had the honor to interview Dr. Nancy Wexler. Many of you may recognize her name immediately because of her contributions to Huntington's disease, but I'll share just a little bit of background first. Nancy is a professor of neuropsychology at Columbia University, and she's also president of the Hereditary Disease Foundation. She's best known for her contributions to Huntington's disease as a geneticist, as back in 1979, she led a famous research study in Lake Maracaibo, Venezuela, where for several years, she and her team developed a pedigree of over 18,000 individuals spanning 10 generations, collecting blood samples from over 4,000, and it was this research that ultimately led to the identification of the Huntington's gene on chromosome 4. She's received many honors and awards over the course of her career, including in 1993, the Albert Lasker Public Service Award, which she was awarded for her research, policy development, and scientific advocacy for Huntington's disease. Nancy was very gracious with her time. We spoke for a little over 2 hours, but of course we've edited down that conversation into a part one, which will air today, and a part two that will air next week. We don't have time in our podcast today to share Nancy's discussion regarding her family's history of Huntington's disease. But briefly, I'll share that her grandfather was diagnosed with Huntington's chorea, as it was called then. Her mother's three brothers were all diagnosed, and then ultimately her mother was diagnosed as well. And so Nancy decided early in her career to research and learn about this disease. I want to go ahead and reveal something about Nancy as well, which is that earlier this year she disclosed that she too has Huntington's disease. In the New York Times on March 10th, Denise Grady interviewed Nancy, and it's published in an article titled Haunted by a Gene, in which Nancy publicly acknowledged her own diagnosis of Huntington's disease for the first time. And so that's where we'll pick up today in my interview with Nancy, where I asked her about that decision to reveal her own diagnosis.
Well, it's something that I still regret having. I mean, I regret having Huntington's. I would not have chosen that. But I think it was clear to me, you know, watching myself, I'm watching videotapes of myself all the time, that I was moving a lot. And I thought, gosh, Nancy, what are you doing here? And it was really, in a way, comparing one time to another. You know, probably or the earliest one, I don't, you know, but then each one, you know, I seem to be moving around significantly more.
So now let's go back in time to the early 1970s. Nancy knows her family history, but obviously not her own diagnosis yet. And she makes the decision to devote her life to studying this disease and to looking for the HD gene. She has heard about families down near Lake Maracaibo in Venezuela who have Huntington's disease, and she decides to take her first trip down there. She's going to discuss how an approach to learn about a different genetic disease, familial hypercholesterolemia, gave her an idea about how to study HD. Specifically, how two scientists, Brown and Goldstein, learned about familial hypercholesterolemia from studying individuals who were homozygotes. Here's that clip.
The very first time we went down, everybody else bailed because it was too hot and disgusting. So they didn't show up even in Maracaibo. And Tom, you know, hung out in Maracaibo. And so we said, and again, we were there because of Brown and Goldstein. Recent discovery of familial hypercholesterolemia. AFH had been discovered because Brown and Goldstein found a homozygote for that illness. And you know, so their team studied a little kid named Stormy Daniel who got a heart attack at 7. Both parents got heart attacks in their 40s. So by studying, you know, the kid and the parents, they were able to really figure out that the cholesterol was a whole problem, that it, you know, cholesterol didn't go into your cell. With Huntington's, again, all the homozygotes, you know, like cholesterol, FH. But we said, but, you know, extremely rare. So we said, well, how likely is it that anybody's going to be married? It was super likely, unlikely anyway, in rare, And how likely is it that anybody, you know, two people will, you know, with Huntington's get married?
So now we'll pick up with Nancy in Venezuela on this first trip. She's been told that there are some families reportedly with HD who live next to one another on Lake Maracaibo. She's going to tell the story of meeting those families and the children for the first time.
He, you know, clearly had sort of initial Huntington's, although he was, you know, walking around fine. And then he said, you know, my wife is over there. And she was smoking a cigarette. And just, you know, also three back and forth in this hammock, you know, red, black, striped hammock. You know, she was gorgeous, brown hair, you know, steely kind of features. But all, you know, gorgeous smiles, thin, gorgeous smiles. They had, you know, she was clearly also mid-stage Huntington's. So I said, well, how many kids do you have? Well, I had three miscarriages. So I thought, oh my God, that's only homozygous. Because she didn't know, you know, if you could even live, you know, God only knows. And then I had 14 living kids. And they're all around her in two sets of twins. I mean, one identical twins, one true twin. One of the twins had died. And one of her daughters, who was about 20, was also already impacted by Huntington's. So I thought, well, is that, you know, is a young daughter in her 20s a homozygous? We didn't know what a homozygous even looked like, you know? Here they sort of teach us about, you know, the difference between Huntington's and non-Huntington's, you know, or different dose, a different manifestation. Right immediately next door, her brother also came over. And again, I mean, you know, these people should get prizes for being gorgeous. And he was my, you know, beautiful angel. That was his name. And I had a little teeny tiny boy who was 4, blonde hair, blue eyes, true big smile, with Julie Huntington's. And he'd been, you know, 6 right from, you know, the age of 2. And he didn't quite have seizures then. And the other, his older brother had been 6 and 15. And that little kid had, you know, just been, you know, walking around, smiled like a true, you know, little tiny stiff man, because he had all of, you know, Huntington's with Juno. So Tom and I looked and we said, oh my God, you know, I said, what was happening? He, you know, we'd never seen Huntington's as a child that young. And had he had another illness? No, polio, no, anything, you know. And so it turned out that his name was Jose Luis Soto. His entire family, 9 kids, and 7 out of 9 had juvenile Huntington's. But then it turned out also with those two families, you know, and their relatives, that they were the very first to, you know, to actually provide the marker. And then Jose Luis, you know, sequencing his DNA, he had over 100 repeats. And that family actually gave us the gene.
So to recap, here in Venezuela, Nancy has discovered children with juvenile HD. She knows that scientists were able to find the gene for familial hypercholesterolemia by studying homozygotes. And so the hope becomes that by taking a large pedigree of a family with HD, they could use linkage analysis to find the gene's location. So specifically, they would check different genetic markers in the family, see which markers followed with a clinical phenotype of HD in the family, and by following the markers that tracked with the phenotype, they could zero in on the gene's location. Here she explains more.
We had the very, very first workshop in 1979 in the NIH. Now, could you use the markers to find the Huntington gene? Well, what if every time, you know, you find a marker, see if it, you know, travels with the appearance of the Huntington's, the illness, in a really big pedigree. Okay? So we all said, well, that sounds like a really good idea.
We'll pause here for today and pick up next week. Obviously, I want to go ahead and thank Nancy for her time and for sharing her story, as well as her contributions to the field of Huntington's disease. Tune in next week where we will finish the story of how they discovered the gene, as well as talk a little bit about how her trips to Venezuela have changed her and her perspective on the disease. Thanks for listening to this week's Neurology Podcast. Once again, I've been speaking with Dr. Nancy Wexler from Columbia University.
Hello, this is Andy Sutherland from the University of Virginia. Today, I'm very excited to be speaking with my colleague, Stephen Massey, from the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. We're going to be discussing a paper published in this week's issue of Neurology titled Practice Advisory Update Summary, Patent Foramen Ovale and Secondary Stroke Prevention. This paper, Steve and colleagues, with members of the AAN's Guidelines Subcommittee, provide an update to the 2016 AAN Practice Advisory for the Management of Patients with Stroke and Patent Foramen Ovale, or PFO, as we'll use in the podcast. Since that publication, there have been several new randomized clinical trials in this area to inform our practice as it relates to the management of PFO, and the FDA has approved several new devices for this purpose. So with that introduction, Steve, thanks for being here. In the advisory, you and colleagues pose really two main clinical questions, and they're fairly straightforward. The first, you wrote it, in patients with a PFO who have an otherwise cryptogenic ischemic stroke, does PFO closure reduce the risk of stroke recurrence compared to medical therapy alone? So Steve, what's the answer?
Well, Andy, thanks for giving me the opportunity to speak with you today. It's always a pleasure. So to answer that question, there is now accumulated evidence that suggests that PFO closure can reduce stroke risk recurrence in select patients. And the absolute risk reduction is about 2/3 of 1% per year. Or if you look at a 5-year time horizon, it's about 3.4% for an absolute risk reduction. And that would translate to a number needed to treat of 29 patients. So if you close 29 patients with PFO, you will reduce one stroke in that 5-year time frame. And it's worth mentioning that these are generally younger patients. The study is mostly enrolled patients under 60. So you would imagine that the time horizon should be longer than 5 years. Most people you'd expect maybe 20 to maybe even 50 more years if they're very young when this occurs to them. And so the benefit might be larger than that on an absolute basis over a longer time frame, but we don't really have great data on those longer time frames.
Fantastic. So definitely sounds like that there's been a shift from our previous practice advisory where we have a little bit more data to inform the number needed to treat favorable towards closure of PFO. Steve, would you mind just describing a little bit about the new trials that helped inform our updated level of evidence and understanding about this?
Absolutely. So since that guideline update was published in 2016, there have been 3 and I would say a half new studies that have been published. So the reason there's a half is that one of the earlier PFO closure trials called the RESPECT PFO closure trial continued to follow patients beyond the time of their initial publication. And so they accumulated more data and then they published that newer data as well. So I would say that's a half of a new study. But then on top of that, there were 3 other randomized control trials. The GORE Reduce trial, which used a GORE PFO closure device. And then there was a study done in France called the CLOSE trial, which was agnostic to the type of PFO closure device that was used, although slightly more than half used the Amplatzer device. And that randomized patients to antiplatelet or closure or anticoagulation, actually, as a third randomization arm, which I think we'll get to talk about in a little bit. And then finally, there was a small study done in Korea out of 2 centers there that enrolled just 120 patients. The other 2 new trials were just over 660 patients each. So just 120 patients in the Korean study. And that was, again, looking at the Amplatzer device versus medical therapy of antiplatelet or anticoagulation. And so accumulating that new evidence, each of these 3 new trials were positive individually by our arbitrary threshold of P less than 0.05, but with clinically important benefits in the reduction of stroke. And I think it's also important to speak a little bit about the other side of the equation for efficacy, that while there is this reduction in stroke risk, there is also a upfront risk of the procedure. And the summary from all of these studies, about 3.9% risk of a major complication of the procedure. Most of these were not life-threatening and not likely to lead to any permanent or persisting sequela, but worth knowing that number. And the other thing that has come out of all this accumulated data is that there is seemingly an increased risk of non-periprocedural atrial fibrillation. So clearly around the time of PFO closure, there's a small risk of transient AFib, but these studies also suggest that maybe there's a small risk that persists beyond that point. And the estimate for that is about 0.3% per year beyond PFO closure. And that's also something that you need to weigh in your mind and discuss with the patient before proceeding with closure.
Okay, Steve, and just sort of thinking about this new data as a follow-up, if you had to sort of briefly just kind of comment, what do you think is different about this second generation, or I suppose more recent generation of trials compared to the prior studies where we really were wanting on the evidence supportive of PFO closure?
Andy, I think that's a really, really good question. It's something I've thought about, and I don't think we can say with certainty, but some ideas that I've had or that other people have had as well is that the patient selection was more refined. In particular, the last three studies, they excluded patients that didn't clearly have embolic appearing stroke. So if it was a small, deep stroke, those patients would not have been randomized. And so that certainly could just be intrinsic small vessel disease. And you would imagine a 50-year-old with hypertension, diabetes, and a lacunar appearing stroke, it's more likely that is intrinsic small vessel disease than embolism from their PFO. So excluding those patients was important. And I think also the pool of patients that were being recruited to the study were different as these progressed in time, because initially patients were being closed off label, I think in large numbers. And so the people who were left to be randomized in the trial perhaps were less likely to benefit. I think that's unknown, but reasonable to think about. But as these trials then continued and initial trials were negative or not compelling, then I think there was less of that off-label closure was going on. And so maybe more likely to benefit patients were getting into the trials, which is very helpful.
Well, that certainly makes sense that the more discriminatory we are of the patients that we select for PFO closure in the sense of really refining that population, that's most likely that their cryptogenic stroke was related to their PFO, the more likely we are to see a treatment effect. And it seems like that bore out some in the eligibility criteria for these more recent trials.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I just wanted to say that, you know, the key word when I initially said that there is a reduction in stroke risk is that I think you have to select the patients carefully. And I do think that's what these trials really did accomplish. And that's why they were so successful.
Okay, great. So, and moving on to the sort of second main question that you and your fellow authors posed at the outset of this practice advisory is this: in patients with a PFO and cryptogenic ischemic stroke or TIA, does anticoagulation reduce the risk of stroke recurrence compared to antiplatelet medication? What did you guys find there?
So there were also three new studies that informed that question. And one of them is that closed study that I already mentioned. That was a closure trial, randomized patients to either closure or aspirin or anticoagulation. And then on top of that, there were two additional studies that looked at the direct oral anticoagulants in patients with embolic stroke of undetermined source, or essentially cryptogenic embolic strokes. And those three studies, together with the data that we had previously accumulated, came out with a summary estimate that did not show a significant benefit of anticoagulation over aspirin. The hazard ratio is about 0.74, or about a 25% reduction, but not statistically significant. And so we can't conclude that anticoagulation is better than aspirin. It's worth noting also, though, that the upper bound of the confidence interval, so the sort of higher end of what we think is probably the true answer, is not much above the no difference arm. So the aspirin, basically, we think probably doesn't have a benefit over anticoagulation. We could say that with some confidence, but we can't say definitively that anticoagulation is better than aspirin, if that makes sense.
That does make sense and probably mirrors what we feel on clinical practice, which is that there's probably not much difference between which antithrombotic you use in this patient population. So for the most part, folks generally stick with antiplatelet therapy, but not enough data or statistical strength to really point us in one direction or the other at this point.
Yeah, I think that's right. There may be some reason why you think somebody should be anticoagulated if they've had a venous thromboembolism that was unprovoked. You know, those patients probably should be anticoagulated for the rest of their lives. And if they then have a stroke off anticoagulation, I think closure you could consider, but anticoagulation I think is obligatory.
Of course, that makes sense. So Stephen, then following sort of the answering these two main questions for the practice advisory, you go on to have a series of more specific recommendations for neurologists who are encountering folks with cryptogenic stroke and PFO. We don't necessarily need to go into the full litany of these, but do you feel like there are two or three that neurologists really should keep in mind when they're managing these patients?
Yeah. You know, what we tried to convey is that we want to recapitulate or do the same thing as what they did to select the patients for the positive PFO closure trials. And so all of those patients had a very thorough workup before they were randomized. And that workup excluded any other likely cause of the stroke. And therefore, it was the PFO was the most likely cause. And it's just critical to do that because PFO, as you know, is really common in the general population. 25% of adults have it. And it oftentimes in stroke patients is an innocent bystander. But in younger patients without vascular risk factors, it's much more likely then to be the cause. So you got to rule out the other causes first. And to that end, you know, we think that vascular imaging of the head and neck with MRA or CTA is necessary. You want a good look at the structure of the heart with transthoracic and transesophageal echocardiogram. And that TEE is important because while you might be able to detect a right to left shunt using other tests like a contrast TCD, which is very sensitive for that, you won't be sure that it's coming through the atrium. you need to look at that carefully. There's other shunts, such as a pulmonary shunt, that can occur that can cause paradoxical embolism as well. Plus, you want to get a sense of whether that PFO or an ASD, whether it looks like it's a PFO that would be amenable to closure or not. All of those things are important before you proceed with something like closure, as well as ruling out other cardioembolic sources. Also, these studies, all of them had some form of hypercoagulable testing. Now, this is, I think, controversial and really an uncertain area, but at a minimum, I think antiphospholipid antibody testing is reasonable, because if that is truly abnormal and elevated and persistent, anticoagulation would be the proper treatment for that and not closure, for example. And then lastly, something that wasn't done as part of the trials, but it's something we've subsequently appreciated, is that there is a small percentage of patients that have occult atrial fibrillation as the mechanism of their stroke. And so AFib monitoring, as you know, is something we do routinely now in patients with a cryptogenic embolic stroke, and particularly in the older age group. So we think it should be considered for patients certainly over age 45, and even in some younger patients who have certain risk factors, such as left atrial enlargement, serum factors like the elevated NT-proBNP, or some findings on EKG and the P-wave terminal force, and things like that may inform whether or not you need to do AFib monitoring. But we do think it's a reasonable consideration before closure in select patients also.
Is there a specific age cutoff? I know this is really tricky for a lot of our folks out there, just when it comes to who you're ordering the echo with bubble study for, and some of these additional tests, such as a hypercoagulable workup, or does that vary from trial to trial?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question. For the AFib monitoring, as I said, I usually say, you know, over 45, we should do at least a month of it. If there's any other risk factor or suggestion, it could be going younger than that for sure. I think that's a reasonable thing to do. And similarly, for hypercoagulability, I do send it in my younger patients under 50. I think in the 50 to 60 range, I'm doing it before closure because that was what was done. And rarely I have found some patients where I think they actually do have antiphospholipid antibody syndrome, and it did change the management.
Yeah, no, and I think that's something that we'll see a lot of variability with in my own institution as well. And generally, we think, you know, somewhere less than 60 or so is where we're going to be really targeting most of these folks. But it is going to vary depending on the additional comorbidities, as you say. But bottom line, I think it sounds like, just to summarize, that these folks with cryptogenic stroke who you're working up for PFO closure need at least to have good thorough vascular imaging head and neck. They need to have good morphological evaluation of their heart, obviously, including the identification of the PFO. They're going to need some rule out of hypercoagulable states. And then lastly, in the right patients, some degree of cardiac monitoring to rule out paroxysmal AFib. And that would be a good summary of kind of defining the cryptogenic stroke patient for this population.
Yeah, I agree.
Excellent. Well, Steve, sort of taking all that together, it sounds like the advisory really offers excellent guidance for most of our practice as it relates to PFO and cryptogenic stroke. As you look forward, what are the outstanding questions that you think might be addressed in the future and perhaps would inform a future practice advisory in this area?
So I don't look forward to doing another practice advisory, but I think there are some questions that need to be answered. So one of the things that we looked for was whether there was any heterogeneity of the effect based on age. And most of the studies did provide this data by dichotomizing patients under 45 versus over 45 up to age 60. And none of them, and in aggregate, they did not show any difference in those age groups. So there's no diminution of a benefit up to age 60. And it raises the question of whether maybe patients over 60 should be routinely being closed, assuming, again, that you've ruled out any other cause of their cryptogenic stroke. And it's important to note the Korean study did enroll patients up to age 80, although we don't have a great sense of the actual distribution of those ages. So even in patients who are slightly over 60, up to age 65, if they're a healthy 65-year-old with no other cause of their stroke and they have a big PFO, you know, I think you can have the discussion about PFO closure with that patient as well. But we don't know beyond that point, and we don't really know even conclusively above 60 what we should be doing with those patients. And on a related question is, what is the relative efficacy of anticoagulation versus closure? And I think in particular in those older patients where closure is of unknown safety, we do know it increases the risk of AFib. We do know older patients are at risk of AFib. So perhaps just anticoagulation is the best option for those patients. And I think a true randomized study looking at older patients comparing anticoagulation versus aspirin would be beneficial. And then finally, you know, PFO closure devices, they're relatively quite safe. And that's, I think, good to know when you're recommending it. But there is uncertain long-term risk. I think, you know, as we follow these patients for decades, since they are quite young, what happens to that device? Do the patients have a higher risk of AFib at a younger age? We don't really know that. And I think it'll be interesting as time goes on, as we learn more about that.
Very good. Well, we'll look forward to all of that, hopefully coming out at some point. perhaps not another practice advisory, as you say, but I know that a lot of hard work and diligence went into this one. And thank you for your time and bringing this to a current practice for our listeners. I'll just encourage everyone, not only to listen to this podcast, but do seek out the full practice advisory update summary, Pain Framing of Valley and Secondary Stroke Prevention, which will be published again in this week's issue of Neurology. Steve, thanks so much again for your work and for joining us.
Thank you, Andy. It's a pleasure, and I hope everybody stays safe out there.
This is Jeff Ratliff. Please check out this week's journal, which features an interesting article on how cognitive decline profiles differ in Parkinson's disease dementia and dementia with Lewy bodies, and an article on tobacco smoking and risk of Parkinson's disease. And don't forget to check out Neurology's three subspecialty journals, Neurology Genetics, Neurology Neuroimmunology and Neuroinflammation, and Neurology Clinical Practice, as well as our mini-sites on Equity, Diversity and Inclusion, Global Neurology, and Innovations in Care Delivery. Thank you again for listening, and have a great week.
The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.